Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about memory models. So you read two papers, well, part of one paper and another paper, talked about memory models. I'd like to start out with a sort of motivational example for the topic. So this is an example here of a pattern which at least used to be very common in Java code and is also broken. The idea that the person writing this code had is that we're going to have this helper object, and we only want to have it around if we actually use it. So we'll initialize it on demand. And we might use it for multiple threads, so we need to synchronize that. But really, you know, I want to deal with the common case where I don't have to initialize it and make that faster. So I'll just check whether or not it's null. And if it's not, I don't have to initialize, I can just use its value. So that's the sort of intuition the programmer here had. Because, you know, it's either null or it's not, you know, there's no in-between state that really matters. And this was broken in Java. And in fact, broken enough that real Java implementations would produce very wrong results if you tried to use this pattern. And still quite possibly will. So what's the problem here? Does anyone see it? It's pretty subtle. And it has to do with what happens after this function executes when you try to use the helper object it returns. Yeah?
So I think if two threads execute this, say both of them enter the first one, say, exits the synchronized part and begins to return helper.
Okay.
It gets taken off the CPU, and the second thread comes in, gets the lock, initializes a new helper, because...
So that's not a problem,
because
the synchronized block is a lock, by the way, if you aren't familiar with Java. So only one thread can enter this part. So as far as... So this is, as another hint, this is completely correct if Java had a sequentially consistent memory model. But it does not. So if Java has a sequentially consistent memory model, we only initialize the object if it wasn't null. We do that under a lock, so only one person does that at a time. And we rather have it null or it's not. Yeah?
Does this have anything to do with how the compiler optimizes the way the helper checks?
So there are two ways. There are problems with this that have to do with compiler optimizations. But you can have problems without that. But the biggest problem is from compiler optimizations, yes. So you think it's optimizing a way to check? Which channel?
I would assume that it's getting the helper,
okay,
copying it somewhere local, and then comparing that with the null for both checks.
Okay, so your assumption is that our memory model says, says that the compiler doesn't have to do this read after the lock is required. So fortunately, the Java memory model was at least good enough that that didn't happen. That the compiler was required to not move a load across a lock. But there are indeed, that could be a problem. We could imagine it being the case that it's safe for the compiler to move a load before a lock required. But that's not safe. And it's good that it's not safe because that would break a lot of uses of locks. Okay. So the problem has to do with this constructor here. So this constructor is going to write a number of values to memory, specifically in whatever memory the helper object is allocated in. And those writes could occur after the write to the actual helper array. There's two reasons that could happen. One is compiler optimizations could assign the value to the helper variable from the memory allocation function and then call the constructor. And that's invisible in a single-threaded program. And according to Java's memory model, it's also safe to do as far as multi-threaded programs. The other way that could happen is that there's a memory write to the helper variable, and there's a memory write to some values in the helper object. And those are two memory writes that could be reordered by the processor or the memory system. So the bug is that the return value of this function might give you a not completely initialized helper object. And you might try to use that, and then something very bad will happen. And yeah, I like this example because it's a good example of how memory models really tripped up people. Because this does something which seems very impossible, which is that apparently this, from as viewed from other threads, this constructor executes after the assignment, which is ordinarily completely impossible to do in Java. So any questions about this scenario? Yeah.
What's the actual error that you would see from one of the threads?
So some thread using gethelper would say call a method on gethelper, and something initialized from the constructor would, for example, be null. So and you get like a null pointer exception. That would be the typical problem. Okay. And it's really subtle, really rare, but an actual problem. So that's part of our motivation for looking at memory models, is that people really do make these errors, and they're not crazy to think that this should work. Because the way most people are taught about threads that and how programs execute is that there's nothing happening here which would cause this to be problematic. Especially if you know, as was usually true, that pointer writes to references are atomic. So you don't have that problem. So another scenario we might think about is locks, implementing locks. So let's say, I'm going to implement locks with compare and swap. It gives me an about old value I want to check for, and if it's there, I set the new value. And this makes it easy to implement a lock, where I make the lock 1 if it's set, 0 if it's not. So my lock function is swap 0 for 1, and if that succeeds, I got the lock. My unlock function is just set the lock to 0. This makes sense? So this is a very simple implementation of a lock. And let's use it. So we're going to have a counter protected by a lock. And we'd like to get counter equals 2. That's our sort of possible result. But given what we know about memory models, are there other possible results of this? Is there something we're missing that was discussed in a paper that might be necessary some places in order to make this actually happen every time? So what other types of thing, what safety nets did the memory consistency paper talk about? Anyone remember? Yeah.
I think one of them was like an acknowledgement message from memory once you've written to it. So you might have to check after you say counter possible one, if indeed the memory was already updated.
Yeah, so the problem you're worried about is that this memory plus equals 1, sure, it's going to update memory, but that might not happen immediately. In particular, it might happen after this unlock. You've done nothing here in the case of a machine with one of those less good memory models, those relaxed memory models, to say, oh, this lock write needs to occur after I've done the updates in the before it. And so a result you might get is timeline is that let's say CPU1, it acquires the lock. Saying distributed cache coherency, it acquires the lock, it owns it, it sets it to 1. It reads the counter, just a normal read, doesn't acquire ownership, and gets that it's 0. Then it says, oh, I'm going to increment that value I just read. So it does that. And it sets it locally, and maybe this write happens to take a while, because it's in a remote memory, for example. And then you can write back the lock quicker though, because it's a local memory. And you got this case where we did the write to the counter as far as we're concerned, immediately. But the write doesn't complete for our remote CPU until after, until after we actually send the modified value of the lock that we unlock the lock. And this is a case where making writes fast by buffering them got us into trouble, because we allowed two stores to be reworked. So what's the fix for the lock? What should I add to this to make it work correctly?
I'll try another loop afterwards that compares the expected value that should have been in the current value.
So your idea is to add another loop. So why would that solve this problem?
Because after comparing the swap, hopefully the value should be set in the expected value, right? If it's true, in which case you want to verify it by reading every event.
So the problem is that locally, if I read the value of the lock here, or the value of the counter, I will see the right value.
Oh, it's cache, okay.
Yeah. And if I try to acquire ownership, that might even succeed too. So what we had to implement this in the paper, we had some fallback mechanisms. So one of them was a read-modify write, but you needed an additional guarantee that read-modify write operations prevented things from being reordered. And some systems provided that. That was their safety mechanism, safety net, as the paper put out. That they said, if you do a compare and swap, I'm going to guarantee you, in addition to changing the value of that variable, that I'm not going to move stores across that for you. I'm going to keep things consistent. But the other form were memory fences, or barriers, where you have this special operation you call, and it makes sure the processor says, okay, you have a memory fence here, I'm gonna make sure everything I've done before that memory fence is actually complete, and visible remotely. I'm not going to let this happen. I'm gonna wait to hear back that, oh, yeah, I got the counter and I set its value remotely. Not going to let that just sit in my buffer and let you proceed. So by adding memory fences, we can make this lock actually safe on a processor with that more relaxed memory model. And on some processors, it's the case that this compare and swap operation also acts as a fence. And that's how you write fences. I believe that is true in XV6, for example. So does this addition make sense? And so we have these fences, which allow, you know, say, make sure those operations before the fence are actually completely done, not just done locally. And this means also waiting for invalidations. And that's the tricky part. That's not enough that we've sent an invalidation to someone. We need to actually make sure that they processed it and aren't going to read in the middle. But a notable thing that fences do not do, which we'll talk a little bit about later, is that they don't change anything about other threads. So other threads can still reorder things regardless of how many fences our thread has. It just makes sure that we do the operations in the order we expect. So generally, to have two threads do same things, you're probably going to need fences in both if this is the mechanism you're using to make sure you get reasonable results that make sense. So the paper also talked about another variant of fences, which is acquire release. And these traditionally you can think of as one-way fences. That acquire is a fence where you make sure that things after the acquire aren't done before it. and release is a fence where you make things that make sure things that are after the release, that are before the release aren't done later. And this is exactly what you need for a lock, actually. Because you want things in the critical section, the time where you have it locked, to be when you definitely have that lock. And so some processors provide these fences instead of the more general one to implement for implementing locks, the idea that you can be slightly faster by allowing, for example, things after the release to be done earlier, on the assumption that they're not in a lock, so it doesn't matter if they're done earlier. So with that, are there any general questions, comments about the papers before I move on to more examples?
One of the papers mentions a big problem was there was no standard at the time of its writing. Is there a standardized memory model?
So from the programming language perspective, yes. So that paper that we read the first section of about the C++ memory model, that is now part of the C++ standard. And something very similar is now part of the C standard. So they specify the memory model that you, as a C++ or C programmer, see. And the compiler is responsible for doing whatever it has to do to make that actually correspond to your machine memory model. Whatever that means. So if that means they have to insert fences, they do that. If that means they can't reorder things that the compiler would like to optimize, it means that. And as you can see from the C++ paper, they chose a very loose memory model. So their memory model in that paper leaves this broken in C++. It says that, if you don't have a lock, sorry. You can see this reordering. So this is still that C++ memory model, that data erase free. There's still a race because you're going to be writing helper and reading it without synchronization from different threads. In particular, you're going to be writing elements in helper, internal elements, which is the problem, without reading it. So they leave that broken. So other comments, questions? Yeah.
Just on the general topic of the sequential and relaxed consistency, I know the first paper kind of said that there was a lot more you could get out of relaxed consistency because of performance optimizations that were available.
Yeah.
But I looked online and it seems like, it looked like AMD kind of has, or not AMD, but
Intel?
ARM?
Yeah, ARM has more relaxed.
Kind of does the relax, and Intel was mostly sequential. It wasn't strict sequential, but
yeah. So let's talk about what people actually do and what the benefits are then. So let's start with Intel, whether it's sequential. So it's not quite. So here's an example program that exhibits a memory inconsistency on x86. So we start with x and y as 0. And then I set x equal to 1 and read y in one thread, and set y equal 1 and read x in another. And if this is sequentially consistent, these are all the possible orderings. So one option is that the writes x and y happen first, and then the reads happen. So we get 1 and 1. Another option is that the write to x and the read of y in thread 1 happen first. So we read 1 for y, but this read of x has to happen afterwards, so we read 0 for y, but the read of x happens afterwards, so we have to read 1. Or the opposite, where thread 2 executes first, so 8 gets 0 because nothing, thread 1 hasn't had a chance to run, and then thread 1 is going to read 1. But with sequential consistency, you can't get 0 and 0. It has to be the case that one of these two, one, the x equals 1 or y equals 1 executes before any of the reads. Does that make sense to everyone? Why with sequential consistency you can't get 0 and 0? Okay. And so I ran this on my desktop 100 million times. And these are the results I got. So 0.003% of the time, I got 0 and 0. So this is an example where x86 is not quite sequentially consistent. And you can see why it's tempting to do this optimization, because they're just reading y and x earlier, because there's no reason to believe there's a dependency. And this will very rarely mess up real code. This is not a scenario like the one we started with double check locking, where we had to have two stores happen in a different order. This is a case where we're doing loads a little earlier than we should, but at least we aren't changing the order of two stores, which is probably the most confusing case for programmers. It also illustrates why this is a very annoying problem to debug, because 0.003% of the time, after setting things up, so we got this either running first, about 50-50, so they're very nicely synchronized beforehand, we see this problem. And that's sort of typical of bugs of this sort, is that they're very rare. And you can imagine if you have like a big system at like Google and you see this problem happen once every, like 3 times in every 100 million requests, it's going to be really annoying to debug. And it's also something which gets worse to debug as you like add synchronization or printing around it, because you change the time and make it less likely that you happen to be exactly at the right time. And so what x86 did here, as I said, is that stores can be reordered after loads to different addresses. So x86 has a write buffer, like we saw earlier, and it allows the writes to complete after apparently unrelated loads. And as far as we're looking at one thread, these are completely unrelated. Within a thread, you don't get this problem. x86 guarantees you that your thread sees your own writes immediately, because that would be really confusing if you didn't. You wrote a value to memory, then read it and got something different, and no other thread was doing anything. So the guarantee is that you see your own writes immediately, but your stores might be placed later than your loads. And sometimes you can notice this. So that's the omission x86 made. But x86 avoids making the other omissions. We guess we should look at like what's the cost of that. Like, what are we actually saving by having this relaxed model? And we can think about sort of two types of places that we're doing memory reordering. And there's the first one, which we talked about last time, with Dash. Dash, we had this interprocessor network, and it was big enough that we could have cases where the network would definitely cause reordering, where things were far away from each other. So we had some things which were local versus not. And that meant that the remote things would definitely see things later naturally. That's typically not a problem on x86 because they use, except for large systems, broadcast-based cache coherency. So we have the other issue, which is in the processor, where we're doing reads and writes out of order. Because we do out of order execution, we want to execute that load as soon as we see it. That's what the real gain is. And we do write buffering. We don't wait to hear from other processors. We just put a write in the buffer and move on. And that's definitely what we want to do for code which is not accessing shared data. And so we'll look at these processor things for what happens in detail. So for out-of-order execution, why don't we notice a problem with out-of-order execution within a single thread? What does the processor do to make sure that we see things within a single thread as consistent?
Well, for loads and stores? What are things the processor could do?
Well, it looks for data dependencies in that thread, so something depends on the AI talk about.
Yeah, so if you vaguely remember the NIRSAR 10,000 paper, they had this data structure where they determined of all our pending loads and stores, which depends on which. And the idea is that you can look at that and you can say, oh, okay, if I see, you know, load in a store for the same address, I can keep them in order. Otherwise, I'm free to reorder them. And if I see stores to the same address, I keep them in order. And within a thread, this is enough to give you consistency in the thread. Because you know there's nothing else going on. So for a single-threaded CPU, for one CPU, this is enough to give you sequential consistency. And besides these two restrictions, which come up very rarely, you can reorder things however much you want. But to provide any of the consistency models beside any of them in the paper, we're going to need to have more restrictions. So talk about that. I'm going to talk about common ways in which we actually end up reordering accesses. Because one model you might have had earlier, because as far as we know, you know, it might as well be the case that processors just executed loads and stores in order. But that's not what they do. So there's sort of two things that cause them to be out of order. So one is something commonly called load bypassing, where you just say you have a load, you look at it, and you look at your list of pending stores that are before the load in program order. And if you have all of them and there's no conflicts, you can just run the load. You don't need to wait. And in a single-threaded program, this is perfectly safe. And what many processors, including x86, really want to do, is do this even if there's other processors which might be writing this value. Because it seems really disappointing to not be able to do this load early, to have to wait until you compute the value for this store and actually do the store to do it. Even though we know that, as far as we know, that there shouldn't be any, almost all the time, there shouldn't be any reason why this load won't just return the same value. Another thing that processors commonly do, including modern x86 processors, is called load forwarding. So let's say we do discover a conflict. We can use the value that we're going to store there and say, oh, that's the value that load's going to return. We can read our own write. And very rarely will this be wrong, as far as sequential consistency is concerned. Usually it's right that if we just wrote a value, we can just read it. And so this is another case where you can get into trouble, where if there's a store that has to complete in here, from another processor, you're going to reorder that as far as the thread is concerned. Move the load. And this is the sort of inconsistency that x86 still allows. Just because this is a really convenient optimization to do, especially with something like x86 where you don't have that many registers, this is really, really helpful for performance. Because if you write something to the stack and then read it immediately, you'd really like to just use the value that was just written without needing to do any actual talking to the cache. And you can do that. So, any questions about these optimizations? So, in spite of optimizations like this, the NIRSAR 10,000 implemented some of these optimizations, at least load bypassing, and still had sequential consistency. So how can you do that? What's a way you can still get sequential consistency? Like what do you need to know to give you sequential consistency in spite of doing loads apparently at the wrong time? And stores apparently at the wrong time relative to load. Yeah.
You have to somehow guarantee that you were the only one that has communication with memory between load and store. So like, you would have to guarantee you had like membership of the bus or something, or ownership of the bus.
Okay, so your idea is that it seems like the only way you can do that is if you make sure everyone else stops.
Or you're more precise about where the other threads are.
Or you like carefully look at everything that the other thread's doing and reconcile it earlier. That seems possible, but either very expensive or very hard. Any other ideas?
You could just introduce the idea that certain adders in memory can change at any time or are volatile in some way, so you can't do these kind of operations on those specific things.
Okay, so we could mark which addresses in memory are, could possibly change. Have we seen anything where we marked addresses in memory as things which might change or might not change? Say, last week? So, in particular, an optimization we can make is that, let's say, we know that some value we're reading is in a cache in the shared state when we do a read, and up until some other time. We know that the effect of reading that value any time while it's in that shared state continuously is going to be exactly the same. That reading here earlier is going to have exactly the same effects as reading here. So we can do a read here, and as long as we know that the value doesn't change from the shared state to some other state, we know that it hasn't changed its value, because there's something would have had to happen first, an invalidation or an update we would have to receive. So as long as this is the time when we logically do the load, it's still safe. So if we keep track of what's happening in the cache, we can get this property. So we can do our read early here, and then when we finally get to committing the read, when we have our read and the reorder buffer and we want to make sure it's okay, we just check that that cache line hasn't changed state. It's been shared the whole time and nothing has happened to it. And that lets us pretend that we read here as far as consistency is concerned, because we would have gotten the exact same result and done the exact same calculations if we read when we checked the state. Yeah?
Aren't you just kicking synchronization to the cache system, though, at that point?
Yes, so we're kind of kicking it to the cache system, but this lets us start our calculation early, which was the important part of the optimization. And it's probably gonna have to be in the shared state before we can get the value anyways. So this lets us read values out of order, but still appear to read values out of order as far as when we start the computation, but still be assured that it's the same effects as if we read them in the order in the program, as far as every other processor is concerned. Just because we could have read it at the time we were supposed to and gotten the same answers. And the cost of doing this is that we need to have the cache do extra work for us to make sure that this stays in the shared state or something aside, next to the cache. So that's for reads. We can also do the same sort of thing for writes. We can say a write is logically done when we have the cache line in the modified or the exclusive state. And as long as when we actually do the write, the cache line is still in the same state and we haven't lost ownership of it, you know, we know it's the case that we could have done the write here as far as every other processor is concerned, because none of the processors could have gotten the value we wrote. So we can logically do the write here, but actually do it later, and we know that that's safe for sequential consistency. So what's the reason that x86 might have not done this optimization here? and still gotten done this sort of tracking and still gotten sequential consistency. What's the performance disadvantage? Yeah?
You have to broadcast the thread who's just taking ownership has to broadcast. You have to wait for the broadcast to get to you.
Yeah, so in order to do commit this right here safely and have sequential consistency, we need to make sure we're in the modifier exclusive state. We need to make sure that we've actually invalidated every other processor already, which means that we would need to wait for that to happen. And x86 doesn't want to do that. And their cost of not doing that is that they let us see these results which are impossible if we just interleave the instructions. And it's a very good reason to do that because there's usually it doesn't work. But if you actually wanted sequential consistency, you can get it, and the only cost is you have to do the invalidation earlier. You don't actually have to finish any more of the write earlier. So we have our different optimizations where if you want sequential consistency in spite of these optimizations, we can still do it, but there's a little extra cost. And the biggest one is for write buffering, for that doing stores later. Is that if we want that to be safe, we need to reserve the cache block for our cache early. And that's a big cost, because that's most of the cost of the write is going to be communicating with the memory system and the other processors to reserve the cache block. And so that's the most commonly omitted thing to do. For load bypassing, we just need to check the cache state when we actually really do the load after all those stores happen. We need to make sure, it's still shared. And if it's not, the mechanism that MIPS used to handle it was the same as the mechanism they used to handle an exception. They just treated it like an exception, except instead of calling an interrupt, an exception handler, it just restarted from that instruction again, redid the load. And for load forwarding, it's the same thing. So we got a value from our write buffer, but we actually need to check when that load actually is supposed to happen in program order, that thing is in our cache and was in our cache, is still in our cache with the right state from the store that happened, that it was forwarded from. And this seems like a lot of extra tracking to do. So you have to know which store it is and then make sure that that store is still around in your cache. So any questions about these mechanisms, optimizations? So do people have opinions about whether sequential consistency is worth it? Or any of these extra work is worth it? Yeah?
I guess one thing you do is compare the speed that you get from multi-threading your program to the sequential thing. Didn't they say the multi-threading was way better even with no optimizations on each thread? So if that's the case, then it wouldn't work, right?
Yeah, so one thought, so I guess, yeah, so if you can do all these and it's still a lot faster, there's a good case to be made that maybe we should be sequentially consistent. And there's a lingering question of how much do these optimizations actually matter? That we need to do extra work, a lot of extra work for. And this is, I think, the primary reason why we have such a diversity of memory models. We saw all these different things processors at the time and proposals for memory systems at the time were doing, where they chose varied in whether they chose to relax, reads crossing writes, and writes store order and other things. And sort of our current world is, I think ARM is like one of these models. x86 is basically the TSO model, not quite, But it's basically TSO in this paper is what x86 does, which is it relaxes writes to read, writes following reads, so they can have the reads can happen before the write, and you can read your own write before other people do, which are exactly those write buffer optimizations. But we saw all this variety, and some of these processors are still around. And some of these require a whole lot more work for the program, where you can mess up ordinary programs that way.
So that was a question I had. To what extent can dealing with all this just be pushed to the compiler writers? Are there cases where the programmer actually has to?
So if you use, if the way you're programming threads is by using libraries like this, where you're just calling the lock and unlock functions, then you don't need to do anything except you need to assume a model like is in that C++ paper, which is this the data race free model, where you just need to use this if you ever want to send values between threads. That's the rule. So as long as you have the discipline to not try to do like double check locking, which is a tricky thing to teach people because it's not the intuitive model of how threads work, then yeah, that's it's just you use the synchronization primitives and don't worry about it. But it is a problem for the compilers. So in particular, in addition to the compiler, like you can't avoid knowing about it in a compiler. So I'll give two examples. So one very contrived example here is here's some code that we're going to run in two threads. If x is 1, we increment y. If y is 1, we increment x. And in every single memory model we've looked at, this code is completely safe by itself. There's no race. There's no case where we're writing a value and reading it without synchronization, because we're only one, assuming that with x and y equals 0. There's no case we're doing that, because we're gonna read x and y, and we're not gonna write anything. So it looks completely safe. But attempting optimization that you might do if you think that this branch is nearly always taken. Let's say you're a compiler and you think x is nearly always 1 and y is nearly always 1. You might say, I'm going to just assume I increment it and undo that if I'm wrong, because I assume it's nearly always taken. But that's going to be very wrong in every single memory model we've looked at, because we're going to be having, we have a race here that the compiler created for us because it made this assumption for optimization. And so the compiler needs to be aware of the memory model in order to know this is not safe. You aren't allowed to do this because you are introducing, you're changing the result of the program based on how threads will interact. So this seems very contrived. Does this make sense to everyone? Yes? No? But there's some less contrived cases. So let's say we have a struct of byte values. And we just write to the last few values in the struct. A very good idea, and much faster, is to read the these 4 bytes as a single 4-byte integer and copy those values in there and store it back as one 4-byte integer. This is completely broken under our memory model that we give the programmer, because our programmer says, oh, I'm accessing A from another thread, that's completely safe. With this, if the programmer accesses A, and that even with sequential consistency, if the access ends up here, they'll miss that write to A, which seems impossible. And there's no, as far as the programmer is concerned, these are separate values. questions? So this is a way that compilers have to be aware.
So I guess the mechanisms by which you can guarantee sequential consistency are just too expensive to just apply everywhere and not worry about it, even by a compiler, right?
Yeah, so if the underlying system isn't sequentially consistent, very much so. Because a memory fence is going to basically say, you know, we're going to have this load store buffer, we're going to wait for it to clear, which could take a long time. Who knows how long that value takes to compute. And even with it, it really, really constrains the optimizations you have available to you in much less contrived ways. Because the compiler can't move any variable right to a thing that might be global. Which is really bad for optimization. So I think we're gonna switch to a focus group in a bit. But first, I'll introduce what we're gonna talk a little more about this topic next time. I'll talk about what reasons you'd want to write code directly against these memory models rather than using sort of high-level primitives like our lock. Why would you actually do this directly and where would you get performance improvement? And we'll also talk about synchronization constructs like this in general. In particular, this is sort of the mechanism I've given us for implementing synchronization, this sort of test and set. And that's the simplest option, but we'll read some papers which tell us that it's often not the fastest. So one paper is going to tell you why it's not the fastest, and the other paper evaluates 27 different locks on like 30 different programs and figures out which ones are best and comes to very mixed conclusions. So that's next time. Forward to seeing you. So Ryan is gonna try to get feedback on